The following talk was given at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on June 2, 2019. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to see you all here and nice to be back at Dharma Field as always. So, we have a beautiful, incredibly beautiful day today, so we all just go out and take a walk instead, maybe? I shouldn't have tempted you. May start seeing people file out pretty soon. Anyhow, so we know what season it is. We think it's sort of summer, it's late spring, but also it's baseball season. For some of us who are fans, this means something. I know the Twins are having an exceptionally good season. I'm a Brewers fan from the other state there next door, but I'm pleased for you people here. So. Brewers are doing okay too, though. Anyhow, I mention that because my talk will involve baseball today. So fan or not, you have to listen. So knowing that I am a fan, for my last birthday, one of my sons bought me a book about the mental side of baseball called 90% Mental by a man named Bob Tewksbury, who is a former major league pitcher. The title of the book derives from one of the delightful malapropisms and misstatements from the late, great Yankee catcher Yogi Berra. Some of you fans might remember Yogi, a wonderful player and a very interesting speaker. So Berra, the title comes from what Berra said once. He said, "Baseball is 90% mental. The other half is physical." So I'd have to tell you another one. That's one of my favorites that almost seems like a Zen koan. So one day someone said, "Yogi, what time is it?" And Yogi said, "You mean now?" So think about that one a little while. See if you don't wake up pretty quick. Anyhow, when Tewksbury's playing career as a pitcher was over, he got a master's degree in sports psychology and became a mental skills coach for a number of Major League Baseball teams. That's right, a mental skills coach. In the past few decades, Major League Baseball has come to realize that along with having physical skills, mental preparation and attitude are important for success in baseball. So in the book, Tewksbury goes over the kind of mental programs he offers to players to help them succeed in what is a very difficult game, if you really think about it. After all, a hitter is supposed to make contact with a 3-inch sphere thrown anywhere from 80 to 100 miles per hour from a distance of 60 feet 6 inches. I had to look this up. It means that the ball takes less than a second to get to the plate, like about half a second or less. So just think about it. The hitter is up there. His job is to make contact with that ball. He has less than a second to decide what kind of pitch it is, where it might land up, and whether he wants to swing at it or not. That's difficult. In fact, it's so difficult that someone who has a 300.300 average is considered a good hitter, meaning that hitter fails 70% of the time. What other field did you say, "Oh, I failed 70% of the time. I'm a great this or that"? I don't think there are too many. Now, a pitcher doesn't have a very easy job either. He has to hurl this 3-inch sphere from speeds up to 100 miles per hour and have it meet the catcher's mitt 60 feet away at the exact spot the catcher and the pitcher agree upon. And along the way, the ball may curve downward, may go side to side, may sink down. That's tough, too. I really can't imagine how anyone plays this game at all, to tell the truth. So a pitcher, a hitter, while he may have great physical skills and training, can still get anxious, fearful, frustrated, and can overthink what he's doing. There's a lot of pressure on players to perform and perform well on a consistent basis. There's always that threat of being sent down to the minors, and it happens all the time. Two experiments, it happened to him any number of times. So that's always hanging there. So as I read the book and read about these practices that Tewksbury recommended to players, I realized that there were parallels between what Tewksbury was recommending and our practice. And this didn't greatly surprise me, because I always felt that what the Buddha taught was not some kind of special Buddhist doctrine or practice, but just basic human truths and practices that are available to anyone, no matter whether you're whatever your religion may be or lack of it, or whatever walk of life you came from. This is something that is available to you, to every human. It's interesting to remember that the Buddha welcomed people from any caste to his practice, which was somewhat revolutionary, and still would be, I think, to some, not as much, I think. But so, in a sense, it's not that surprising to me that a mental skills coach might come upon or grasp onto some of these same practices. Now, I want to be clear, I'm not claiming that Tewksbury is a Dharma teacher and is teaching all his players to wake up and is teaching what the Buddha taught. Not at all. But his reading it reminded me of some of the basic practical ways that understanding Dharma can help in our lives, to help us to live lives with understanding and love. It also reinforced the idea that the Dharma is not just about sitting on our cushions, but is integral to everything in our lives, even baseball. So Tewksbury, first of all, tells his players about breath. He recognizes that by attending to the breath, you can better deal with whatever situation arises. He quotes Cubs first baseman Anthony Rizzo talking about the use of breath. Rizzo said, "You're always breathing. When stuff starts to speed up on you, you have to slow it down. And the best way to slow it down is by breathing properly. Obviously, the emotions get to you, but you try to stay one level at all the time." So when we sit in meditation, the basic instruction is to follow the breath. When breathing in, know you're breathing in. When breathing out, know you're breathing out. Now, everyone can find your breath. It's always there, fortunately. And we always have awareness at all times, so it's always possible to focus on your breathing. Now, Rizzo may be referring to controlling the breath, but it isn't necessary to control the breath in order to slow things down and feel settled and calm. Just mindful focus, and of course by mindful I mean plain awareness without judgment or added ideas. So just mindful focus on the breath will naturally slow things down. Now, once we've slowed things down, we begin to see there's a spaciousness we might not have noticed in the rush of thoughts and feelings. And in that spaciousness, it's possible to see what's going on with greater clarity. This meditation we do yields calm, peace, clarity, and insight into the nature of reality. Usually we're caught up in our thoughts and feelings, tossed around by them, believing in their solid reality, and thereby acting out of our own narrow views. We usually view situations through the distorted lens of our own wants and needs. It's like viewing reality through a funhouse mirror. But as we calm down, we're able to touch into wholeness, into totality, and act out of that. Acting out of wholeness, we will act in a way that is appropriate to the situation, not because we've schemed and manipulated to gain a result we wanted, but because our action grows out of a holistic understanding of whatever is happening. Acting out of narrow, selfish motivations is not healthy for us and ultimately doesn't lead to beneficial results for ourselves and for others. There's a helpful Zen story about the results of acting out of narrow, selfish views. It's from this wonderful book, which probably many of you know, called Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, which has been just a great resource for me for a lot of my life, really. It has a bunch of Zen stories and koans, and just a great resource. Anyhow, this one is called Black Nose Buddha. A nun who was searching for enlightenment made a statue of Buddha and covered it with gold leaf. Wherever she went, she carried this golden Buddha with her. Years passed, and still carrying her Buddha, the nun came to live in a small temple in a country where there were many Buddhas, each one with its own particular shrine. The nun wished to burn incense before her golden Buddha, not liking the idea of the perfume straying to the others. She devised a funnel, clever nun, through which the smoke would ascend only to her statue. This blackened the nose of the golden Buddha, making it especially ugly. I think it's a wonderfully funny and instructive story, but I think many times in my life I've blackened the nose of my Buddha, probably daily, numerous times. Now, we can come back to the breath, of course, not only during our sitting meditation, but in whatever situation we find ourselves in. We are told we should be mindful at all times, whether we are doing the dishes, driving the car, dealing with a fussy child, stuck in a traffic jam, whatever we might find ourselves engaged in. The breath can be a help here. So if we're really disturbed, we can just stop for a moment and take a few breaths, take a few mindful breaths, and then we'll naturally feel calmer and much more in touch with our actions and the people around us. So slowing down and the insight that can arise with it are important elements in our practice, just as they are for a hitter coming to the plate. Tewksbury also tells his players to be aware of their perceptions, or I think Steve likes to use the term conceptions, I think, you know, for very good reasons. So I'll try to use that term. But it's the same thing that I think Tewksbury is talking about. Our concepts are the mental frames we place around a situation. We all conceive of situations differently. In baseball, obviously, a pitcher has a very different way of viewing an at-bat than the hitter or the catcher or the fielders or the umpires or the fans, depending on their allegiances. If your team is several runs behind, you may not feel each bat as urgent. You may not feel each bat as urgent, at-bat as urgent, as if your team is behind. Tewksbury talks in particular about how a hitter might feel if he hits the ball solidly but right at a fielder who snags it for an out. If this happens for a few games, the hitter might think, "It's not fair. Why does that happen to me?" This kind of thinking, Tewksbury points out, leads only to frustration and can produce no positive results. It's the same for us in our everyday lives. We subscribe to conceptions of situations which are fruitless, unhelpful, and in some cases destructive. As I mentioned before, our conceptions are often based on our own narrow likes and dislikes, our wants and imagined needs. We convince ourselves that these narrow views are the right ones and that we are totally justified in the actions we take based on these distorted views. You might want to consider this quote from playwright Philip Barry's The Philadelphia Story. The time to make up your mind about people is never. We could modify it to say, the time to make up your mind about anything is never. Suzuki Roshi tells us that not always so is a good mantra to keep in mind. And Thich Nhat Hanh says that the question, are you sure, is helpful to ask ourselves about whatever we're thinking. An incident from when I was in grad school, I think, illustrates that we should always be open to changing our views and to not fixing on our views. There was a woman I knew then who I was friendly with, who, when I passed her on campus, I'd, give her a wave, a friendly wave, and she'd walk right by like that, not even glancing in my direction. So I was a little hurt, and I thought, well, she's awfully stuck up, isn't she? Couldn't she even take the time to, am I so far beneath her that she couldn't take the time to wave back or nod or say hello? Well, not long after, I found out she was extremely nearsighted but didn't like wearing her glasses. So she didn't, not that she didn't want to greet me, she couldn't see me. That was the problem. But in a sense, by making up my mind about it, I too was blind. I didn't see her. And I didn't have my insight glasses on and realize there might be some other reason. And I didn't ask myself, am I sure? The Diamond Sutra tells us where there is perception, conception, there is deception. Whenever we attempt to put reality into a concept, a delimiting box, we're doomed to failure. Reality can't be put into a box. When we place a situation into our conceptual boxes, we inevitably leave something out. And besides, nothing remains the same even for a moment. We simply can't pin anything down. I'm thinking of Norm's turn, unpindownable, which is a wonderful addition to our language, Norm. Anyhow, things are unpindownable. So we can never pin anything down or know all there is about a situation. All situations, everything is a manifestation of totality. Now, this isn't to say that we don't need concepts. We do. We can't do without concepts to live our lives. And concepts, of course, are absolutely key to the Dharma as well. Without the Buddha's teachings, none of us would be practicing today. We're reminded of what Katagiri told Steve when he said, we can't talk about this. There's no way. He said, well, you have to say something or no one will understand. So as soon as you say something, you're dealing with concepts. So we're lucky that the Buddha did say something and that we are able to practice today. And without the guidelines the Dharma offers, such as the Eightfold Path, we wouldn't have a way to wake up. But we should always be aware that we don't have the complete picture. We should not attach to concepts, even Buddhist ones. We should always be willing to ask ourselves, are you sure? Tewksbury also tells the players he works with to focus on whatever is happening at that moment, not on regrets about the past or fears about the future. He says about hitting, well, whether you're 0 for your last 10 or 10 for your last 10, a hitter's job is exactly the same every time. Focused on one thing and one thing only, and that is seeing the ball, which is, as he said before, pretty good trick. Takes a lot of focus. Then, when it is time, focus on the pitch after that. He goes on to say that if a hitter is focusing on his fear of being sent down to the minors, if he doesn't start hitting, he will tighten up and attempt to do more than he's capable of. The same advice applies to pitchers. Instead of worrying about striking out the batter or what your next pitch will be, just focus on the pitch you're currently making. Cubs pitcher John Lester said about this, "It really simplifies things, taking it one pitch at a time. It's almost like a game within a game. I want to win this game. I want to win this pitch." Tewksbury also notes that the outcomes are out of our control. Once the batter hits the ball, he has no control over what happens to it. Maybe it will land in a fielder's mitt, or maybe it will drop into the gap for an extra base hit. All the player can do is make contact the best he can. The same is true for a pitcher. Once the ball leaves his hand, he has no control over what happens to it, whether the hitter will hit it or miss it, whether it will be a ball or a strike. And all of us would do well to follow this advice. All we ever have to work with is now. The past is gone, the future is yet to come. We have only now to work with. As Lester says, taking one pitch at a time simplifies the game. All too often, we make the moment more complicated than it is by adding worry, expectations, fears. Taking one moment at a time simplifies our lives. There's nothing complicated about now. Ultimately, it's just this, thus. It's simple and whole. Of course, from a relative point of view, it appears to have many parts and much complexity, but still, it's just what's happening. If we can slow down and act out of the whole, we will act appropriately. It's a scene from a movie some of you may have seen a number of years ago called Bridge of Spies. It's about the spy, Soviet spies, Rudolf Hess. And this scene illustrates the absurdity of complicating a situation with worries. In the scene, Hess's attorney is in his jail cell talking to him about the case against him, warning of the dire consequences if he's convicted. The attorney then looks in a puzzled way at the very unrattled, calm Hess and asks him, "Aren't you worried?" Hess replies, "Why? Would it help?" And in fact, Hess never did come to trial. Instead, he was exchanged for the American pilot the Soviets had captured, Francis Gary Powers. So all his worry would have been about nothing in any case. And even if he did come to trial, would worrying about it help? A few years ago, I had a sore spot in my abdominal area and was convinced that it was a hernia. Years before that, I did have a hernia and had surgery on it and a long and sometimes painful recovery. So I was quite worried about another hernia surgery. So I went to see my doctor. Guess what? It wasn't a hernia. It was just a sore muscle. So did my worry help? Maybe it prevented it from being a hernia. Who knows? But I doubt it. So I spent a lot of mental energy on a fantasy. How often we complicate our lives with worry and fears, or with anger and lies, or pride and conceit. Does worry ever help? If I'm stuck in a traffic jam, does it help to curse my fate, or be angry, or worry about whether or not I'll be on time for my appointment? All I have to do is just wait, just be. In a sense, it's no different than sitting meditation. We don't do anything particular when we meditate. Why not treat the traffic jam as a moment to just relax and be? I have to confess that on the way here today, I had an opportunity to experience this. I didn't run into a traffic jam, but there was a detour. 94 is closed by the intersection with 494, 694. And I knew this, and we had planned a route. And I was going to leave 10, 15, 20 minutes earlier just to make sure I'd get here. Well, I didn't leave earlier. So what happened along the way? Well, I was worried. And I said, okay, now I'm giving this talk today. I've got to make good on this. And it's hard practice. I worked with it. I did. And it was helpful. But, you know, that's I was remembering what Katagiri said. You can only be patient when you can't. And that's really true. So it's a good practice. So next time you're in a traffic jam or have some tense situation, realize this is a wonderful time to practice. What a great opportunity. Anyhow, I had to come clean on that one. I was sure we wouldn't get here on time for the meditation. And guess what? We got here 10 minutes earlier. So there we go. The importance of worry, right? Anyhow, as I've been just indicated, our worries and fears rarely turn out to be good predictors of the future. But even worries aside, how much does any given day conform to our plans for it? Years ago, Scott Edelstein, who some of you know here, gave an instructive talk right here, Dharma Field. What Scott did was to chronicle one day in his life to see how much happened that was unexpected, unplanned for. Results were striking and amusing. I can't really remember the specifics anymore, but I do remember how amazing it was how much of this day, his day, was taken up with things he hadn't planned on. So I've always meant to try that again. I never did, though, maybe. But it might be a good exercise some of you might like to do. So just as John Lester focuses on the pitch he's about to deliver, we should focus on whatever we're doing in this moment. We should act mindfully, taking care of whatever is in front of us. Worrying about outcomes or counting on a particular outcome or attaching to all sorts of ideas about a situation is futile, as we never know what will happen even in the next moment. Realistically, it's only possible to act moment to moment. One of my favorite Zen stories illustrates the wisdom of paying attention to everyday moments. This is actually a koan from the Gateless Gate called Jashu Washes the Bowl. A monk told Jashu, "I have just entered the monastery. Please teach me." Jashu asked, "Have you eaten your rice porridge?" The monk replied, "I have eaten." Jashu said, "Then you had better wash your bowl." At that moment, the monk was enlightened. I always liked that story. So Jashu pointed the monk to the immediate situation. If you mindfully wash your bowl, you are expressing Dharma. Dharma isn't about doctrines and ideas, though they are helpful in pointing us in the right direction. As the Zen teacher Bankai once said, "My miracle is that when I feel hungry, I eat, and when I feel thirsty, I drink." Or Linji Rinzai once said, "The miracle is not to walk on water. The miracle is to walk on earth." Though the player's Tewksbury helps probably don't gain deep insight into reality, although am I sure about that? They are probably more successful in baseball and maybe even happy in their lives outside of baseball. Dharma is about practice. It's not about mastering certain doctrines or believing in the Buddha. It's about our everyday, every moment lives. We need to learn to slow down and look mindfully at what's going on. We need to learn to not attach to views, but be open to each new situation as it arises. We need to learn to take care of each moment of our lives without getting involved in worries, fears, and expectations. And we can learn these things. In fact, we already know them. We only need to learn to let go. We let go each time we sit on our cushions and come back to ourselves, each time a Dharma talk points us in the right direction, each time we have a moment of mindfulness during our day. When we practice this day, our lives will not only be peaceful and happy for us, but we will recognize that we live interdependently with all, and we will benefit others as well. Thank you. Any questions, comments? Yes, Larry.
I have a comment about Yogi Berra. One of my favorite Zen sages. And the great thing about him was he come up with all these sayings, you know, and he didn't try to do them. You know, it wasn't like he was making an attempt to be funny or clever or anything. People just asked him to just do these things just naturally. One of the ones I like from him, I've got a whole list of these anyway, but one of the ones I like from him, I think somebody was having some problems in his life or something, talked to Yogi about it. And Yogi said, if the world were perfect, it wouldn't be. That sounds very Zen-like.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
He has a lot, there's books out about collections of his sayings.
Yeah.
Anything else? Yes.
Mike. I was thinking about the story where you were worried that you might have a hernia and you went to see the doctor. But in a sense, you know, worry did serve some sort of function because it got you to see the doctor. Well, maybe you would have seen the doctor anyway. Maybe you would have said, oh, that's interesting. Maybe I better go talk to the doctor about it. You know, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a motivator to get it checked out.
Yeah, that's true, but I probably could have done less fantasizing about how I'd have this hernia and how the operation and take me out of commission for how many weeks. But yeah, I see your point.
Yeah.
Concern, at least, would be good.
Concern, yeah.
Yeah.
Warren?
Yes?
I actually don't know anything about baseball and I don't like it. And I was never any good at it. I was always the last person they picked on the team, you know. But your talk was, I think, really, really good. It makes me want to read that book because one of the hardest things to me is bringing Zen into everyday life, you know. I mean, here, you know, it's attractive, the intellectual pursuits and all of that, you know, all that comes with that. But then, you know, having it in your life, seeing it, you know, there, I think is you know, like being in the traffic jam is challenging. Mm-hmm. I think your talk was very illuminating. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
I might even watch the baseball.
It's a wonderful game.
You got me interested.
Well, good. So there's some good result there. Maybe I didn't get interested in Zen, but I got you interested in baseball. Yes, Mary.
Helen's comment about the difficulty of bringing Zen into everyday life. I don't know about that. I mean, what do you think about that? Do you think it's difficult to bring Zen into everyday life? Or do you think, it's not that Zen isn't part of everyday life. I have trouble with the idea of separating Zen from everyday life, that somehow sitting on the cushion and practicing is not everyday life, but it is. And I don't know, when I feed my cat, I find Zen most helpful then, and driving. I have to pay very close attention. She's up there on the counter. She wants to lick the bowl right away, lick the can. I have to make sure she doesn't knock anything off. You know, it seems like just attending and letting go to what you're doing is really benefiting everyone. I don't know what you think. I don't think we should make it a problem. I don't know. We have so many problems. We need that problem. I don't know.
No, I don't think we should consider it a problem necessarily. It's a practice. You know, I find that it's hard to convince myself that this moment is it.
Yeah.
That I sometimes think, oh yeah, I want to get wake up, or I want something spiritual now, and I think about what can I do that would be spiritual, instead of saying, how can I be here right now? And this is really it.
That's
hard to convince yourself. We're so convinced that it's not it. That it's just, oh, that's just feeding the cat. That's not. But no, it is. Everything is. Feeding the cat. It's just as you say. But no, I mean, once you can practice mindfulness readily anytime. You can come back and...
I must say, I hate the word mindfulness. It's such a buzzword.
It's become a buzzword. It's true. But do you have a better one?
I like what Norm says, being the awakeness and awareness that we are.
Mm-hmm. Too long.
Could you say that? Being the awakeness and the awareness that we are. Being our true nature, when mm-hmm. you say that.
Yeah, well, that's good.
That's our true nature.
Okay.
Being the true self. That's who we are, mm-hmm. the true self. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You know, it gets very zenny and people don't like it. But then people don't like it. And they like, you know, back and forth. I'm sorry. I'll shut up.
That's all right. It's okay. Anything else? Yes, fire up.
I'm not a baseball fan, but I love the NBA. You know, I follow that. You hear a lot of the athletes. In all sports, but in the NBA, it's talking about being in the moment. You know, it's very, very common thing. Steph Curry talks about the joy of being in the moment, you know, playing the game. He seems to take a lot of joy in actually being present. I mean, it's, mm-hmm. So you do hear that a lot from the athletes, I think, and it's kind of physical awareness of things as they happen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, apparently, reading this book, this mental skill stuff at first was looked down upon by, that's for sissies or something. That's rot, you know, that's, and then it's begun to catch on now. But, anything else? Yes.
Unformed, cornered as I speak, aging. Requires being in the moment. And I find healing from wounds, accidents, knee replacements requires being in the moment, mm-hmm. paying attention in order to continue without injury, without accident, without chaos that could come from injury, accident, etc. Mm-hmm. So athletes have an advantage, but also aging offers a parallel path without the veracity.
I mean that it takes longer to heal?
Well, a number of stages to it, but mindfulness, paying attention, allows one to listen to the body, answer what it means, mm-hmm. help it heal, mm-hmm. move into back into or into everyday life or create a new normal, another cliche. Mm-hmm. And if you have metal, if you have other issues, those issues help you develop an attention, a mindfulness, just as deeply, just as importantly, if not more so than athletes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Part of that could be like just being aware of what you can and can't do, or something. Mm-hmm. Not conceptualizing about things.
Just being resolute. Can I pass that rock? Can I avoid that crack?
That's true. You do have to. Your body does change, and what you used to think about. Oh, I can do this. Maybe you can't, or it takes longer, or it's harder, or so. Yeah. Yeah.
You're right in the moment. You need to attend to it. Ideally.
Right. Right. Anything else? Yes.
I attended a St. Paul Saints game when I'm very Zen-like, because it's not for a championship. They're not professionals there. It's a totally separately, never trying to get anywhere. it was just about being in the ballpark and enjoying it. And I'm not, maybe attend one game every 5 years or so, but it struck me that that was just about being there and enjoying the experience more than becoming an Anakin other than it is.
Mm-hmm.
And they played in the Milwaukee Milkmen. I don't know if you're from there.
Excuse me?
The Milwaukee Milkmen were their opponents.
Okay. I love the name.
Yeah.
I like that name. I'll remember that.
Milkman.
Oh.
That's a terrific name. That's really good.
Not alcoholic.
Right. Anything else? Well, I just have to throw in one more Barra-ism, yogi-ism, I guess they call them, that might help you on your road to life. When you come to a fork in the road, take it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.